Hi, everyone. I'm Anita Lustria, and for many years I did live radio. Then I transitioned to the podcast world where I feel I found my home. I love talking about spiritual formation, justice issues, and spiritual practices. Throw in the Enneagram, movies, and current events from time to time, and that's what you get on the podcast. I'm glad you've come along for the ride. Welcome to Faith Conversations. Welcome to Faith Conversations, everybody. You are in for a treat and also a very important topic as we'll be talking today with Ryan Casey Waller. Just a quick shout out to a friend and podcast listener in Australia. I got this beautiful, huge, lengthy email. Words are my first language. Or whatever, printed, written words, whatever. I love reading a long email. My husband gets the long Christmas letters, you know, and he goes, can you synthesize this for me? And I just love reading every word. So thank you for that really long email. And now I want to move to Australia. So thanks for that. And I've heard from others of you, but I just had to do the Australian shout out, especially. If you want to write and comment on what we're talking about on the podcast, or just tell me a little bit about your story and where you're listening from, I'd love that. Shoot me an email at producer@anitalustria.com. Producer@anitalustria.com. All right, into the topic of the day, the guest of the day. Ryan Casey Waller is a licensed psychotherapist, lawyer, and pastor, and that's quite a combo. He's heard all the jokes about being both lawyer and priest. You might be thinking of one right now. Ryan, thank you so much for being with us on Faith Conversations. Really appreciate your presence here today.
Thank you for having me.
Excited. Well, I'm excited too. Wait till people hear the topic. All right, you ready for this? This is Ryan's book, Depression, Anxiety, and Other Things We Don't Want to Talk About. Yes, you just turned up the volume a little louder, didn't you? I'm sure of it. And Ryan, I think one of my actually first questions is, when did you start writing this? Was this before the pandemic began or as it began? You know, I'm thinking about how timely it is and wondering when you actually started writing it.
Wow, nobody's asked me that. Yeah. So I started writing the book in October of 2019. So right as the pandemic was getting going on the other side of the world, but we weren't really aware of it in the ways that we should have been. And then was writing really through those early months of the pandemic. And so what's interesting about it is I was having to create the manuscript at a time in which there was great uncertainty that was unfolding. And, you know, writing in and of itself can be a very isolating, you know, activity.
Yes.
And so to do it, during that time, it was actually a bit of a difficult process. I knew that writing this book was going to be hard because I was going to have to revisit some aspects to my own story that I knew might be triggering for me. And so I was prepared for it to be difficult. But then for the pandemic to come along and to do it, it was doubly difficult. So it was actually a tough time to write it. But as I turned in the manuscript and then began going through edits, and then we continued to see what was happening in the world, I couldn't help but think, I knew that folks were going to need this book, but goodness gracious, I was like, we're all really going to need this book and other books like it and just more of these conversations.
Oh my goodness. Talk about timely. Yeah. That's why I wondered when you started writing it and how that unfolded. Also, are you an introvert or an extrovert?
I'm an introvert.
Okay. So as the haiku that I wrote many during the pandemic, but one of them, my favorite, shelter in place is a treat. Wait, shelter in place for an introvert or something, for an introvert, here we go, for an introvert, shelter in place is a treat until it isn't. It's like,
absolutely.
You know, it was kind of nice for we introverts on the front end until it wasn't anymore.
And
right?
Until it wasn't anymore. Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we introverts can, we build our energy and we love to be alone, but the reality is all human beings were designed to be with other human beings. And so at a certain point, it's too much of a good thing.
Yeah.
We need to connect. We need to be able to delve deep into those relationships and have experiences with other human beings.
Yeah.
And without them, over a long haul, it takes a toll. Mm.
Amen to that. So let's dive into your personal story. You already alluded to that, and I think it's really important for people to know that you are writing not just as a clinician, knowing these things are good for people or wanting to talk about depression, anxiety, and other things. You have personal, straight up, big time experience. So tell us what your family looks like. You're married and have kids. I read that. And then that gives us a little context too. Then, yeah, tell us a little bit about your story.
Sure. Yeah, I am married. I've got two children, two little ones, two little boys. And I grew up, my family of origin, mom and dad, I'm the third of four. And ever since I was a little boy, I was aware that I was more on edge than other kids around me. I mean, I noticed from an early age that things that made me nervous, things that made me tense up, it didn't seem like that was happening to the other kiddos around me. And I can recall actually going to my parents and expressing this fear. I would say it like this. I would say, things feel like they're moving too fast. Things feel like they're moving too fast. And my parents, God bless them, I remember were so kind and patient. I remember my dad looking me in the eye and asking me to describe my feelings, to be with me, and all that. But it was the 80s, and it just wasn't the thing that people would immediately say, hey, I think my child might need to see a therapist, right? I just don't think that ever entered their headspace.
Well, and I'm curious too, how old you are, if I can ask that. You're a guy.
Sure.
You don't care, I'm sure.
I don't care. I turned 39 on Tuesday, this past Tuesday.
Awesome. So, so I'm 60. So I knew I knew you were a lot younger than me, but I wasn't exactly sure. And I'm also wondering, and maybe you as a, today as a psychotherapist, is it, or was it not unusual for someone of your age and generation to feel that way growing up? I think I'm a boomer. We didn't have that as much, I think, or maybe we just didn't describe it.
I think that it wasn't described. I think there's this sense in which, mental health has been exacerbated, or maybe it's gotten worse. Now, I do think there's some issues, particularly now with basically since, the introduction of the iPhone, that adolescents are experiencing that are different.
So millennial generation up, probably.
Yes, yes. And we can talk about, there's some very specific sort of mental health struggles that we're seeing more acutely that we haven't seen in the past. But directly to your question, I think mental health and mental illness has always been there. It has just been so highly stigmatized that in generations past, the idea was like, you just bite your lip and get on through this. So yeah, I think other kids were probably experiencing this as well, but it just wasn't something that was necessarily talked about. And I'm not even sure my parents, I don't think it even went into their head that this would be something that maybe, we should talk to somebody about. I think it was just, he's having these thoughts. Let's be there for him. Let's be open and all that. So it's not a faulting them at all. But that being said, I grew up trying to make peace with it on my own, and eventually coming to the conclusion, I remember about probably the time I was in college, that I was like, this is just my cross to bear. Mm. I mean, that was very much my thinking, because I was a strong Christian, believed that God was present, believed that God was with me, but just thought, this is just what I have. And this is my thorn in my side, right?
Right.
As Paul
thank
might
you,
say.
Paul. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Paul. Appreciate that one, brother. So, I just struggled until really my late 20s, early 30s, when I just could struggle no more on my own. I had battled anxiety, and I had battled feelings of despair, which again, I labeled as despair. I didn't know it was depression. And eventually the way that it came out for me that became untenable was I began having panic attacks. And if you've never had a panic attack, they're hard to understand, but it's like a chemical hurricane in the brain. And for me, they manifested very, very physiologically. So my heart would race, I would sweat, I would be dizzy, and my brain on loop would repeat, "You're going to die. You're going to die." And it was sheer terror. And they would last for me for quite some time. They could be anywhere from 30 minutes to upward of an hour.
Oh, thank you for describing this, because I'm thinking 10 minutes. I'm thinking, okay, not a little 10-minute, 5-minute, 15, no, okay.
Yeah, they're long. For a lot of people, they are shorter. And the first thing, if you're out there and you're listening and you have panic attacks, the two things to know about panic attacks are, one, they will pass. It feels like they will not pass, but they will pass. Okay. And two, they will not kill you.
Oh, okay.
They cannot kill you. And there's those two pieces of information are sometimes people have to know to get through them, because the reality is, the reason why we want to be so proactive about anxiety and panic is that once a person's in a panic attack, there's really nothing that can be done short of sedation. They have to ride out the panic attack and it's horrible.
So self-talk in the middle of it is like huge, or can you even self-talk in the middle?
It's very, very difficult. It almost comes down to just those two things: reminding yourself that this too shall pass, right? So it's like you're at the dentist or something, and there's intense pain, but you know the dentist is telling you just a few more seconds.
Right.
Like humans can endure a lot if we know there's an end, which is part of the reason the pandemic has been so hard, because people don't see the end.
Right.
And we can endure a lot if we know it's not going to kill us.
Right.
So those two things, you know, we kind of boil down the self-talk typically to those two things. But I began having these, and I was like, that was my breaking point. And I said, I have to see someone. And so that's what got me into the therapist and a psychiatrist, and began the whole process of exploring psychotherapy, and then the process of figuring out if I needed medication, what kind of medication, and thus my healing journey began. But I look at that, I mean, like you said, like, I'm 39. It's really been only for the past 10 years that I've availed myself to those resources. Prior to that, I didn't. And I can really, I say this in the book, like, I can divide my life into two halves.
Wow.
Like, the half, like, you know, short of accepting the love of God in my life and choosing to follow after God and marrying my wife, opening myself to psychotherapy and medication is the third most important decision I've made, because I make no bones about it. The life I live now and the work that I do now would not be possible had I not opened myself to that form of healing.
Wow. Okay. We heard that. I have so many questions, and I'm trying to keep this in a coherent thread. One question actually that immediately pops up is, why not sooner avail yourself of medications? And maybe this is the time where we talk about some of the stigma. You know, if we grew up in, like, I grew up in a conservative Christian background, and you know, it was like what you talked about, this is your cross to bear, or this, or whatever. It's, you know, medication or go to counseling, especially to a psychiatrist, maybe to a Christian counselor, period, but not anyone that could prescribe medication. Talk about that.
Yeah. For me personally, I think psychotropic medication, for me to accept that I needed that, meant that I was somehow accepting that there was really something wrong with me, right? So here's how averse I was to it. I worked with a psychiatrist for almost 6 months with him telling me that I needed to try medication before I would even try it. Like, so I resisted it. So there's a medical doctor. Right. Imagine any other situation which a medical doctor is telling you, right? Like, you need an antibiotic for the infection that's in your body, or we cannot get your blood pressure under control. We need to take this. Now, most of us, right, are gonna listen to the medical doctor and say, you know, yes, ma'am, yes, sir, I will take that because my health is important. Mental health medications are just different. For the reason, I think primarily, is because they're so highly stigmatized. But I think it goes to that deeper issue of identity. There's an acceptance that's very, very difficult. People say this over and over to me again. Well, like, they say, I don't want to have to rely on a pill, right, to make me happier. That means there must be something wrong with me. And to me, this is it's a very valid concern, and I know it so well. And it runs even deeper for Christians, because we think, well, wait a second, like, if I believe in the God who of all healing, the one who calls himself the Prince of Peace, right, like, why on earth can I not, like, get there on my own? We have to understand that mental health is not something distinct from our other physical health. Right. It is the foundation of our overall health.
Ooh, say that again. It is the what?
Mental health is the foundation of our overall health.
Right there. Take that sentence with you today. Just sit with that one. Yeah,
there's a lot there, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot there. But we want to parse it out and say that it's something different. And so here's the thing. Like, I'm an incarnational Christian. I'm a sacramental Christian, right? I believe that God uses, right, this world that God has created to reveal God's self to us, right? We get this namely in the incarnation, Jesus Christ. Like, when God decides, here, I'm going to present myself as fully as possible to humanity. Here I come as a person. Medicine is one of the more important ways that God has allowed for us to create methods of healing. So I say this in the book, you know, for a long time, once I finally accepted that I needed an antidepressant, I kept my antidepressant in my closet, which, if you're wondering, that's not where I keep the rest of my medication, right?
Right.
And so I had this weird ritual where every night, like right before bed, I would retreat into the closet and I would take this pill and then, you know, go about my business. And my wife was right there. She knew what I was doing. It's not like I was hiding it, but there was a sense in which I was kind of hiding it almost from myself, like in denial. And one day I was doing it and I thought, why am I doing this? You know? So one day I took that pill bottle out from my closet and I put it where my other medication is, beneath my sink. And I said, I'm not ashamed that I take this pill. So I need to stop acting like I'm ashamed. This is one of the ways that God comes to me and keeps me well each and every day. And from the moment I did that, talking about taking that medication became shame-free, because I integrated that into my life. And from that point on, I was able to, when appropriate, talk to people mm-hmm. about the reality that I take medication, and it opened up, you know, about a million more conversations with other people.
Yes.
who feel the same way.
So I'm curious, you know, I introduced you, and it says in your bio, you know, that Ryan Casey Waller is a licensed psychotherapist, lawyer, and pastor. So at that point, when you finally started taking the medication, who were you? What was your profession at that point?
Great question. Yeah, I was working in the church.
Okay.
So I'm an ordained Episcopal priest. And for about 10 years, I first taught in a college prep school. And then I worked in a parish for about 7 years.
Okay.
And it was when I was, it was the early years of working in the parish that I really began to struggle. Mm. And so it was during the course of working there that I not only found healing and got interested in mental health, but then also I got sick again near the end of my time at the church. And that's the story that I begin with in the book, whereas I hit another bottoming out. You know, the thing about depression and anxiety is, for most of us, these are chronic conditions. So now, don't let that scare you too much. If you're out there and you're like, this is why I don't want to admit that I'm depressed, I don't want to be labeled as such for the rest of my life. Depression and anxiety are highly treatable conditions. You know, the American Psychiatric Association reports that about 80% of people with depression who seek treatment experience clinically significant reductions in their symptoms. So, I mean, just take that in. Like, yes, these things are chronic and they often stick around and they recur, but highly treatable. And so I got really depressed near the end of my time working there, and burned out and stopped caring for my mental health in the ways that I know that I need to, which ended up, I tell the story in the book that I show up to preach and I'm intoxicated. And, you know, that was another turning point for me, where I had to get really honest that I needed to step back and I needed to refocus on my own mental health and to come back. Yeah.
And I'm thinking too that maybe that's one way prior to having a mental health diagnosis of depression, anxiety, maybe alcohol is one way people think that they might self-medicate that might fix this. Is that pretty generally true?
Yeah, it definitely is true for those of us with anxiety. If someone comes in and they talk to me about anxiety, I almost immediately ask about the drinking, because alcohol is just one of those things that if we suffer from anxiety, we typically go to it. Lots of us do, because it's the most accessible. It is completely socially acceptable. It's the only drug for which you have to give an excuse for not using. Right. If you're at a party and someone offers you a drink and you're like, oh, I don't want to, like, they will circle back. Are you sure you don't want to drink? Like, nobody does that with cocaine. Nobody does that with heroin. But with alcohol, you know, which is arguably our most dangerous drug, but because we've made it the most accepted drug, it's very, very difficult. So we reach for it because it's easy and it works immediately in the short term with anxiety. I mean, anyone who's ever had any alcohol, you know, if you're a little jittery, and you take a bit, you take a drink, you know, for the most part, it's almost instant. Ah, like there's a little bit of warmth. There's a little bit of safety there. Now the problem with, I mean, we all know the dangers of abusing alcohol, you know, it lowers your inhibitions, you know, all sorts of things can happen. And over time, if you continue to abuse alcohol, it will increase your anxiety, which is very, very difficult for those who are anxious to really want to grapple with and to really want to accept that truth, because it can be so helpful in the moment. But the more your body relies on alcohol, then the more it needs alcohol, and the more it goes into that withdrawal, even if you don't really kind of recognize it as withdrawal. It's this desire, this need to have it, to be in that state, and you'll require more and more and more. And then, of course, in the hangover state, people who really struggle with anxiety, when I ask them, well, after a night of heavy drinking, how anxious are you the next day? And they'll say, oh, it's like the absolute worst. It's the absolute worst. I'm like, that's exactly right, because that's what's happening. And so we're just making the problem worse. So alcohol, we always want to be aware. And that's not to say anyone with anxiety needs to cut out alcohol completely in their life, but we must be conscious about how much we're drinking, why we're drinking, and how we're going about it.
Okay, there was a lot right there. You know, this is where you want to just say, hey, can you come back later and let's finish the conversation while I sit and think about that?
Would love to.
Yeah, exactly. So
yeah, alcohol is a big one.
That's really interesting. And most anxiety depression meds, one of the descriptors or you know, warnings is do not take with alcohol, right?
Always, right?
So what does that do? What does it do if you're on depression anxiety meds?
Yeah, because the reality is, so alcohol is a depressant, right? And so if you just think of it that way, like take it out of how accepted it is for a moment. Let's pretend it's not this thing that we use socially and you just understood it was a depressant and you're struggling with depression and you've been prescribed an antidepressant, would you just on your own choose to go out and take another depressant and just enter that into your system? It's like, no, you wouldn't. But we have a different narrative around alcohol. But that little warning on there is actually quite important. Now, look, a huge percentage of the population are on antidepressants, and you can and again, this is not medical advice, right?
So yes.
Right? Right. And I don't get outside the scope of my practice. But you can absolutely find a balanced life while on an antidepressant and drinking at acceptable levels. But to ignore or to think that that's just some sort of innocuous warning is misguided. It's there for a reason.
Yeah. Okay. So this leads me to the next question, which I didn't realize I was going to go this direction, but... So you were in ministry back in the day when you were starting to get this figured out and struggling initially, maybe. What precipitated your move from ministry to the next profession? And really what I'm wanting to know is how did you eventually land in the licensed psychotherapist category?
Yeah, sure. So for me, the journey began almost immediately when I was even working at the school with the kiddos before I worked at the church, because I realized that as a religion teacher, even then, the kids were coming to me and the questions, sometimes they were asking theological questions, right? They want to know, what does this mean? Like, explain to me the Old Testament, New Testament. But a lot of times they were coming in and they were like saying, they were describing life experiences.
Right.
And they were trying to understand the world in which they lived in. And I began to realize that, oh my goodness, I'm really interested in psychology and not just theology. And then the more that I worked, the more I got interested in the integration of psychology and spirituality. And then by the time I got to the church, what I began to realize is that mental health struggles were everywhere, but there was a strong resistance in my own Christian community. And since then, I've discovered in many, many others, of seeking out mental health professionals. So what would happen would be this. Somebody would come into my office when I was a priest, or still am a priest. They'd come into my office when some issue in their life had really gotten to a boiling point, right? It was really on the verge of blowing up. And what they would want me to do would be to pray for them, right? Or to bless them. It was almost like a Hail Mary, right? Like, nothing else has worked, so I'll come and I'll see the priest, which there's nothing wrong with that. I always tell people, like, especially with my own depression and anxiety, pray about it, right? Avail yourself to your faith community, but praying about it and hoping that it's going to change, that is not a strategy for healing. Like, yeah. God works in mysterious ways. And I'm not going to say, God heals. Absolutely. But like, if you've got a broken leg, like, pray about it, but go
get
to the orthopedist.
To the doctor. Yes, right.
You know, get to the doctor. So people would describe things and I would say, well, it sounds to me like maybe you're depressed. Have you ever considered, you know, seeing a therapist? And people would say, oh no, we don't do that in my family. We don't do that in my family. Or they would say, oh, that's a good idea. I haven't thought about that. And then they would come back in like a month and I'd be like, hey, did you? Yeah. And they'd be like, no. And I was like, why? And they would give every excuse in the book. And I just realized, oh, there is so much stigma here and shame.
So I so want to blame the Christian community. This makes me so mad. It's like what we have done to each other, families, like we don't do that in our families, but then the Christian community, I get a sense that this is more acceptable in the larger, you know, global community, but maybe I'm wrong there.
No, you're right. And look,
I was really hoping you were going to say, no, you're wrong, but I'm right.
No, it's worse. We're perhaps the worst offender. And I say this with all love to my Christian brothers and sisters.
Sure.
And in many ways, it's like, look, we've inherited centuries of this sort of, you know, bias. And we're not far removed, even in the wider culture, of the way that we dealt with the mentally ill was we chained them up, right, in asylums. And
oh,
so that's not that far in our past. So
I forgot about all that.
Oh, yeah. In the back of the book, too, folks, I give a quick sort of history, right, overview of how we got from there to here. And
excellent.
And the reality is we are, when you consider that our prison system is still our biggest mental health provider in this country, it tells us we still have a long way to go.
So can I say, not to get us off topic, but when you hear the term defund the police, it does not mean take away our police departments. No. It means let's discern maybe a better way to fund the police by giving some money to social services, to mental health experts, because police have been asked to deal with situations that they aren't trained for. We need mental health professionals. Am I speaking truth here?
Oh, preach.
Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you're asking, I mean, think about how unfair it is to a police officer too, to show up to, you know, to someone who's in mental health, you know, crises, when what they need is a trained therapist in that moment. And we're asking the police to do too much. And exactly as you say, we want to free them up to be able to go and to do the things that we need them to be doing, quite frankly, and that they're trained to do, and allow other people who are trained to deal with situations. And in the last the last thing, you know, someone who's having a psychotic episode who doesn't really present a threat to someone else needs is a police officer showing up with a weapon. Like, we need someone who's going to be willing to kind of to sit and to talk. And, you know, and granted, I'm so encouraged. There's so many police officers that I've seen who have done such an excellent job of showing up and recognizing that that's what's going on. Yeah. Right. And saying, yes. You know what, the jail is not the place you need to go. Like, let's take you to the hospital. And so that happens a lot, but we're just putting too big of a burden on the police. Yeah. But back to your question about, you know, we were kind of some of the worst offenders. I say it with love, right? Because I don't want to, I call out the church in the book, and I do it gently, right? Because yes. It's scary, and I understand, and it's hard, right? Like, but the truth is, like, if the church, if the bride of Christ is going to be the spiritual hospital that we know it is and that it can be, then we have to make it okay for people to show up with all the ailments, including mental.
And correct me if I'm wrong here also, Ryan, because one of the things that I'm thinking about is, you said, and you do it gently, I so appreciate that, and that this is hard, because we're also asking people to expand and shift and change their view of God in the midst of this conversation, right?
We are. Yeah, we are. Because I think a lot of folks want to believe that God wouldn't do this, right? God wouldn't allow for people to really be sick in their minds. And so it must be a faith issue. So it must be, if you're feeling this way, it's unconfessed sin, or you're just not pious enough, or you don't have a deep enough understanding of who God is. If you could only understand this on a deeper level, then you wouldn't feel the despair or the anxiety that you feel. And the reality is, no, like, look around. The world is deeply broken. People are born into this world with all kinds of disabilities. And some of us come into this world and we are more susceptible to struggling in our mind. And God has allowed that, okay? And that's just a part of the brokenness of this world.
And let me just say, I so appreciate your chapter. I mean, we can't cover everything in a short podcast, but Ryan has a fabulous chapter entitled "Why Does God Allow Mental Illness?" And he's just touched on it right there, and has more to say in that chapter. Oh, I mean, this is a big topic. I'm just, again, kudos to you for dealing with this. And that's not even how I want to say it. Thank you for laying this out in such a helpful way, because that's really what I mean when I say dealing with this. Thank you for really rolling this out in a way that's understandable, kind, and yet firm, all of that. One of the things I heard you say earlier, and I don't even remember the language you used, but just that so many are, mental health is such a significant crisis. There's the numbers are large, those that are on anti-anxiety or depression medication. You have a chapter called Epidemic. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's where you talk about the epidemic of mental illness, or, but I would love for you to speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, happy to. Yeah, we are in the midst of a mental health epidemic. One in four Americans every year will experience a mental health struggle. That is a number that is probably underreported by half, more close to the truth. It's probably half. And imagine, like, what do you think it's been in 2020?
Right.
Think about this.
Or the first 2 weeks of 3 weeks of 2021.
Right? We're in a very weird time, yeah, to put it mildly. I know I love that meme that's been out there where everyone's like, I'd like to cancel my subscription to 2021. I know it's been 2 weeks, you know. But look, we get more than 20 veteran suicides every day. Suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in America. Amongst people at aged 10 to 34, suicide has become the second leading cause of death. Think about this. So our young people, the only way they're dying more often is in accidents, which has always been the case at, you know, at that age, right? That's, you know, That's been happening. In 2017, we lost more than 70,000 people to opioid addiction. So, I mean, picture a huge football stadium, whoa, completely filled, all those people gone.
Wow. Like that,
right? In 2013, suicide attempts and suicide cost the U.S. economy about $60 million, right?
Wow.
The number one reason for disability in the workforce globally is depression.
Wow.
I could go on for days.
Wow.
This is a true public health crisis. And I hope people really hear that. And I think they're actually open to hearing that a new way because of the pandemic. Like, we understand, okay, what is a real public health crisis? Well, like, you know, look at COVID. That's a real public health crisis. This is a public health crisis. Because consider this for a moment. Not all suicide is preventable, which is not an easy thing for me to say. Mm. And it's not an easy thing to hear, I don't think. The reality is that some people's illness is so severe, like similar to cancer. Some cancer comes along and we can throw everything at it. All the best treatment, all the best doctors, all the best resources, but the cancer is just going to do its thing and it's going to run its course and the person's going to die. For some people, they're going to die from depression, right? That's what's going to happen, unfortunately. And I say that, and that absolutely devastates me. But the reality is, for most people who die by suicide, we know, based on talking to people who survive suicide attempts, that they vacillate greatly in the moments just before the attempts, which means that a lot of these deaths are preventable. Mm. Many of these deaths are preventable. If only we can normalize the conversation. By normalizing the conversation, we increase people's willingness to raise their hand and ask for help, and then we increase our ability to get them the help they need, and we can prevent a lot of this.
So on the heels of you just saying that, and this is one section in the chapter on the problem of suicide, the question is begged, what do we need to be on the lookout for if we are worried about someone's mental health? Because that's, I know people are listening and going, okay, I'm hearing some statistics, I'm hearing about the stigma. Some of this stuff I know, some I don't, but what do we do? What does Sally and Joe, citizen and friend, do about this?
I so appreciate the question, because here's the thing. The main thing to be looking for is changes in patterns, right? If someone just has a marked change in their behavior, So just notice someone doing something they don't normally do, or more likely not doing things that they normally do. So like kind of not showing up to social events, right? Someone is in your home who, you know, they love football, or something, not watching, you know, football, the diet change, all those things, the changes. Here's the thing. Your gut will tell you. Most of us kind of know, or will think deep down, like, I feel like I should ask this loved one how they're doing. But when you're worried that it's mental health, so many people don't ask because they're afraid that if the person says, yes, I am struggling, then they don't know what to do next.
Okay.
So let me help you with
this. I'm going to have you help us with that. But that's not what I thought you were going to say. I thought you were going to say, if we're afraid to ask because we're afraid we're going to offend them.
Oh.
Also.
Yeah, there is some of that. Some people ask, I'm going to offend. Let me deal with that. You're not going to offend them. If they're not struggling, they're not going to care. They're going to be like, you know, what's your deal? Like, mind your own business. If they are struggling, what they're going to feel is, oh my goodness, you notice.
Okay.
Oh, you care enough to ask? Because most people, we feel so lonely in it.
Yeah.
All we really want is someone to ask.
Oh.
So you're not going to offend.
Nice. I hadn't thought about the fear of if they said yes, not knowing what to do. I didn't even think about that.
Oh yeah, okay. I think this is, most people think, right. Well, then what do I do? Here's the beauty. I'll tell you exactly what you do.
Thank you.
Don't judge. Do not feel like you have to offer any guidance. Because here's the deal. You don't know what to say. So don't pretend that you do. Here's what you need to do. Be there with them. say this. It sounds like you're in a lot of pain. Mm. And if I felt that way, I think I would be in a lot of pain too. Mm. I wonder if you should talk to a professional. Mm. Because I don't know what to say, but I know that there are people who are trained to do just that. I think you should talk to a professional. And then you just sit with your loved one. That is all you have to do.
Wow.
That in and of itself can be curative because you've given that permit. You've shown that person that you care enough to ask and to listen, to not judge them. And then you are pointing them in the direction they should go because that's what they need to do. So,
wow.
Here's the thing. It sounds simple, but that actually takes courage. That does take courage. So you do have to have courage to do it. But think about this. By just asking, listening, not judging, and then pointing them towards professionals, you may very well save their life.
Wow. That's rather significant right there.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so if you're worried about offending or you're worried about not knowing what to do, I've just taken away those excuses. You want your loved ones to live. Yes?
Yes.
It's worth it.
Yes.
It's
worth it. And you do not need to become the therapist. Maybe there's that fear too. No.
Yeah. And don't. I'm telling you, please don't. You'll make it worse, right? This is what so many, unfortunately, I think Christians, and look, we all mean well, but we kind of immediately start to break it down and we say, well, look, have you read this verse or you need to do this? Like, there'll be a time and space maybe for that. But if a person's really in crisis, they don't have the space for that. They probably don't want that. They just need to know that you care enough to sit with them in their pain for a bit and remind them of what is true, which is that our God does not promise to take away all of our suffering, but does promise to not abandon us to our suffering.
Yes.
You can be that lived truth. You can be that incarnational truth that they're not actually alone because that is how they feel.
Okay. There is so much that we've talked about today, so much more that we did not get to. You talk about talk therapy. You talk about medication. I mean, you get specific and give really helpful information. I feel like addressing this topic, a lot of us come thinking, you know, we come to it realizing we have great deficiencies we don't understand, but you get really specific about things that maybe we wondered about, like what actually does a therapy session look like?
Yeah.
Sometimes we're scared because we decide we're not going to make an appointment. We don't know what that's like. I love that part of the book as well. You talk about biology, psychology, spirituality. I mean, you just go into all kinds of things, and in the midst of it, you intersperse pieces of your own story, which makes it so real and relevant. Can I just say that? And in the back of the book, other thoughts on mental illness that, like mentioned earlier, Ryan has written this brief history of mental illness, a primer on depression and anxiety, and some other suggested reading. This is a terrific resource for you, for a friend, a family member. It's called Depression, Anxiety, and Other Things We Don't Want to Talk About. I can't thank you enough for writing this and for also sharing your story. That, to me, it's like the perfect marriage in this book. Ryan, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Those were such gracious words.
Well, I think it's a super important topic. And as you said earlier in our conversation, it's been talked about a lot over this COVID year. It's been highlighted and elevated, but we've not necessarily talked about good resources to give people. At least I haven't yet here on the podcast. And so I feel so good about this book and really commend it to you. Depression, Anxiety, and Other Things We Don't Want to Talk About. It's published by Thomas Nelson. Thank you. Thank you for your time and your caring and your expertise and for sharing with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And to everyone else, I say keep the conversation going.